From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, September 27th, 2019. We've got a lot of stuff to get to this morning. A lot of it spinning off the big news of the week, which, of course, is the announcement by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, that the House will launch formal impeachment inquiry proceedings, and they are underway. They've really been underway for a while with, I think, six committees tackling different aspects of alleged corruption in and around the Trump administration. And but the speaker coming on board this week is a big, big development. The president seems quite worried about it. We're going to tackle several different aspects of what's been going on in the course of these next couple of hours here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And going to be bringing in John Walters. He is a blogger here in Vermont, writes the Vermont Political Observer blog. Of course, he was formerly columnist with 7 Days, the Fair Game column. And John is going to be joined by Guy Page. Guy Page is a conservative commentator in Vermont who puts out the State House headliners, and he's a defender of President Trump, and so we wanted to get somebody to help us do that this morning because, of course, we like to represent all points of view here on the Dave Graham Show. Latter part of this hour, we're going to bring in Bill Boardman. He is a commentator from Woodstock, out with a recent book called Exceptionalism. American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll. Bill Boardman is someone who is quite critical of essentially all the players on the American political scene. He doesn't give a lot of sucker to Democrats or Republicans, but he has some interesting perspectives that I thought I'd welcome to the program as well. Very latter part of this hour, like the last 15 minutes or so, we're going to be hearing from Congressman Peter Welch. He is going to be calling in to talk to us about his take on the week's events. Of course, being in the U.S. House, he is he's an important player in all of this, and it's going to be great to hear from the congressman, I think. In the second hour of the program today, Allison Stanger is going to be joining me. She's a professor at Middlebury College, and she has pretty darn good timing, I'd say, because she is just out with a book about whistleblowers. And people are using that term, whistleblower, this week quite a bit. So that's got to make her publisher very happy. Fascinating book, actually. Ms. Professor Stanger starts with way back in the 18th century, at the very birth of the nation. There was a fascinating whistleblower case involving the subordinates of a sea captain who was there at the founding of the U.S. Navy and kind of running off renegade and doing his own stuff until his people sort of reported him to the Continental Congress. And the Congress actually passed its first Whistleblower Protection Act in 1778. Wow, who knew? People think of these things often as modern phenomena, but clearly they are not completely. And so we're going to launch right into it right now. I think I've got Guy Page on the phone. Good morning, Guy. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Dave.
And John Walters is here in the studio. John, thanks for coming by.
Hi, John.
Hey.
And I wanted to check in with the two of you because flesh out this issue that you, Guy, among others, have been raising in the last couple of days. Senator Patrick Leahy joined Senators Robert Menendez of New Jersey and Dick Durbin of Illinois in writing a letter in May of 2018 in which they urged that the government of Ukraine, they sent this letter to the senior prosecutor in Ukraine, urging that the Ukrainian government not block investigations of Paul Manafort and anybody else involved in the matters that Robert Mueller was looking into at the time. Of course, the two-year Mueller probe did touch on Ukraine because there was some alleged nefarious dealings there, and the argument from some on the right, including Guy Page, is that the Democrats do it too sort of thing. Why are people getting on President Trump's case? Do I have that roughly right, Guy?
Well, yeah.
And flesh it out a little bit for us. I mean, you wrote about it in your newsletter yesterday, but not all of our listeners have had the opportunity to read it, I suspect. So tell us what your thoughts are about all this.
Sure. So in May 2018, the general prosecutor of Ukraine, a guy named Yuri Lutsenko, gets a letter from Senator Leahy, who's the vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. That's, mm-hmm. that's the committee that decides how the money is spent.
Right.
And another member of the Appropriations Committee, Dick Durbin, and the former chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Menendez from New Jersey.
Right.
And it says, look, we're really worried that you have, quote unquote, taken steps to impede cooperation with the investigation of the United States Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And we quote, we strongly encourage you to reverse course. And he says this after talking about, oh, how in the last 4 years we've really offered a lot of financial and otherwise support. We've helped you build your institutions. Now, we strongly encourage you to reverse course.
Right.
So what you really have is the U.S. senators with their hands on the purse strings saying to a government that's received quite a bit of foreign aid, we want you to do something for us here.
Mm-hmm.
And now one can say, well, maybe there's nothing wrong with that. And I actually, you know, it all goes to motive, I suppose. Is it possible that the senator really thinks that that there's something valid in their supporting the Mueller investigation, and it's just the right thing to do, and we really would like you to cooperate here? And I would argue the same for President Trump, that President of Ukraine raises the issue, says, look, we're trying to drain the swamp over here too.
Let me bring in John Walters. John, what do you make of this? Do you think that there is a direct parallel here, or do you see differences, or what are your thoughts?
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is ask Guy a question. Guy, have you read the whistleblower complaint?
I've read the transcript, not the whistleblower complaint.
Okay. Well, I would question your foundation to compare the two cases then, because there's a lot more in the whistleblower complaint than there is in the transcript of the one phone call. The whistleblower complaint, which is from a credible source in spite of some people's attempts to smear him, outlines an effort over a period of many months by Trump officials and by Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal attorney, to influence Ukrainian officials to pursue an investigation that has been broadly debunked by people who've looked into it, in order to produce or perhaps fabricate evidence about Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. This is not a one-time publicly released letter, as was the case with the senators. This is a campaign waged over a number of months involving clandestine meetings and suppressed information. I don't think the two cases are at all similar.
Guy, here's one question I have about this, which is that you actually raised a very interesting point. Is you have to look at motivation. Obviously, people do things all the time, and oftentimes the question is why. The U.S. uses foreign aid as leverage to get other countries to do its bidding. Essentially, in many many cases, whether it's stop your human rights abuses or don't bust our chops on trade or whatever the issues are, the U.S. will frequently send letters to foreign governments and say, "Hey, we've been helping you out a lot. What about it, folks?" You know, so that so far, I don't think anybody would see anything as necessarily wrong with it. But the motivation issue is very, I think, important here. And a different, you mentioned yesterday when we talked about this guy that these three senators are going after a quote unquote political opponent. But there's a degree of sort of directness of that, which may be, is significantly different. Now, if Patrick Leahy, went to the Ukrainians and said, "We would like you to investigate Scott Milne because, we think Milne Travel has been doing something in Ukraine that is somehow corrupt,"
right,
or whatever. If Patrick Leahy had done that, I would say Patrick Leahy deserves to be impeached. And because obviously Scott Milne ran against him in 2016, could run against him in 2022 when Leahy's next up for re-election, and et cetera. And so, you know, you might imagine a politician wanting to kneecap this past and potential future opponent. There's certainly no hint of that in the letter. I mean, there's no discussion about Milne travel in this letter from Menendez, Durbin, and Leahy. So without that, that motivation of having the target of the call or the letter being the likely political opponent in an upcoming election, where else is the similarity here? What do you see here?
Dave, you're looking at this kind of narrowly, I think. You know, Pat Leahy, he doesn't get up in the morning and think, oh boy, how am I going to beat the sacrificial lamb they run against me in 2022? His biggest rival is in the White House.
Well,
Donald Trump is wait a minute. Donald Trump is the guy who's putting forth candidates for the Supreme Court who he doesn't like before Senate Judiciary. All right.
Yeah.
His big rival, and maybe okay, yeah, it's not likely that Pat Leahy is going to be running for president, and Donald Trump isn't going to move to Vermont and run as a senator. But the big picture here is he's trying to do his part, join the team that's trying to get rid of Donald Trump.
Okay, and so George W. Bush was president from 2001 to early 2009. And obviously of the opposing political party, therefore by your theory, a political opponent of Patrick Leahy. Ronald Reagan was in the 80s a political opponent of Patrick Leahy's been around a long time. George H.W. Bush was a political opponent of Patrick.
He just missed Richard Nixon.
And he just barely missed Richard Nixon, as John puts it. Do you remember any instances of Patrick Leahy contacting a foreign government and asking them to help out with an investigation damaging to Ronald Reagan, damaging to George H.W. Bush, damaging to George W. Bush?
Well, I don't remember any specifics about that, but if anything, that just sort of underscores the almost mania that Washington, the Democratic Washington, has
almost,
about
wait,
Donald
wait,
Trump.
Wait a minute. Almost mania. You're talking about one letter that Leahy sent over a year ago.
As part of the aggregate, John. As part of the whole continuum.
Well, you're laying a whole lot
on Donald Trump.
You're laying a whole lot of, well, one could say that there is abundant evidence of Donald Trump's misdeeds that you are conveniently ignoring.
I think there's some stuff here in Ukraine, Guy, that actually maybe was absent in those three previous presidents' cases. In the case of George W. Bush, George H. W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, if Patrick Leahy does this kind of stuff, he would have been doing it back then just because they are political opponents of these senators, these three presidents were political, and this fourth president, in your estimation, and yeah, I mean, they are opposing political parties. The Democrats do have a lot of grievances with Donald Trump, not just the fact that he appeared to have allowed Russian meddling and encouraged Russian meddling, Russia, if you're listening, et cetera, in 2016, you know, and this call to Ukraine. I mean, these things actually are based in stuff that is beyond mere political opposition. I guess that's the point I'm trying to get to. And the if in fact George W. Bush had encouraged or allowed the a foreign government to meddle in his campaign and help get him elected, then I would think that the Democrats back in the early 2000s would have had some things to say about that. But those things were not on the table until just the last couple of years under the current president. Is that fair?
You know, I guess I see this as who brought this up first? Well, this was Pat Leahy deciding that that Mueller's probe really needs to be supported. And let's face it, not a whole lot has come out of that, right? Out of the Mueller probe?
Quite a bit has come out of it. Mueller basically... I mean, I actually think the only reason that didn't go out is because of some structural things, starting with the fact that there shouldn't be a special counsel. We should just have Congress investigate and bring impeachment charges if a president misbehaves. We'll get to that at another time, though. I'm for scrapping the whole special counsel system. I'm also very much for scrapping the OLC memo from the Justice Department saying that a sitting president can't be prosecuted. The OLC memo, basically, we got to the end of the Mueller investigation, and the reason it came to nothing was because of the OLC memo. The OLC memo says to Bob Mueller, hey, Bob, you know what? Actually, you can't really do anything. You've been on a fool's errand for the last couple of years. And so Mueller says, here, Congress, here are 11 instances of obstruction of justice. Here's all this evidence pointing to an underlying set of crimes. Take it away. And because of the politics, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, they didn't pick it up. They didn't, you know, they fumbled the baton as that section of the relay race happened. Finally, they fast forward to now, and they've got this other case, which is purely between the Congress and the White House. There's no special counsel involved. Now something can happen. Gee whiz. Oh, hey, we got a caller on the line, Ruth from Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yesterday, and I thought the Democrats behaved like idiots, fools. I can't say enough bad things about them. All they seemed to care about was tripping the McGuire up, you know, getting a I got you moment. And then, worse than that, was the media coverage of it. They didn't bring out any of the things, the good points that the Republicans made. They just repeated bad things that the Democrats said. And the difference between Leahy and Trump and the whole situation is that Democrats are above reproach. You can't question anything they do. Everything they do is totally legal, whereas anything a Republican does is suspicious, corrupt, and this is the way I'm seeing it.
Well, Ruth,
I don't feel that way. I have been very critical of Democrats when I think they've fouled up or crossed a line. I don't think Peter Shumlin thinks very fondly of me, for one thing. I've also been I've had a lot of praise for Phil Scott. My purview is Vermont politics, so I don't get to write very much about Mitch McConnell, which I'm grateful for. But I've said a lot of good things about Phil Scott.
I think the media is disgusting. I really, really do. They are not telling us people the truth. They're not.
Or maybe you people aren't listening.
No, we are listening, and we know you're not telling the truth. Why aren't they investigating Joe Biden and his
funny you should mention that. There's a report. The former Ukraine prosecutor who was ousted by the new president, who's a big who's Rudy Giuliani's favorite Ukrainian. Has said that there is nothing to the Hunter Biden allegations. This is the guy that Rudy Giuliani wants to put in charge of the investigation. This is the guy who has carried Rudy's water in the past, and he's saying there's nothing to the Hunter Biden business. You're choosing to believe the conspiracy theories that support your preconceived notion of things, and you're not looking at things in a balanced way. I'm sorry.
No. I see the total picture. I'm very much involved. And
read the whistleblower complaint?
No, I have not.
Oh, congratulations for being so well informed and taking in
all right,
information.
Okay, I'm going to break in here because we're getting a little snarky. But Ruth, I thank you for the call. I understand you're upset about this, and I do appreciate you calling from time to time and expressing your views, and all of that is fine. Thank you very much.
I also appreciate Ruth's ability and First Amendment.
Right.
Yeah. To express her views.
Absolutely.
And
that's what this show is about.
I support my right to be critical of her views when I think she's off base.
Yeah. Well, I do too. I've said many times on this program that I will express an opinion here and there, and I want to make sure that everybody is allowed to do so. Yeah. There you go. Hey, let's go to Joe in Northfield. Dave. Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. A couple of points I'd like to bring up here.
Yeah.
you just said that the Biden thing, that the Ukrainian prosecutor said there was nothing there, or somebody in Ukraine said there was nothing there.
Right.
Well, they have Joe Biden on tape saying that he did what he did. So I don't know who's trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes here, but one of them saying that he did do it, and the other guy is saying that he didn't.
What do they have tape of Joe Biden saying?
That he tried to bribe the Ukrainian prosecutor, or tried to bribe him to get the prosecutor out because his son was being investigated. They have Biden on tape saying that he did this.
Well, this is that same prosecutor saying that there's nothing to the Hunter Biden case.
Well, but how can you have one guy saying one thing and one guy saying another? Who do you believe?
I think that here's the bottom line, sir Joe. I think that the I think you've got to bring a prosecution and put Hunter Biden in the dock if you think you have something on him. This case about Hunter Biden's been going on 2 or 3 years now. Nobody's brought charges. Paul Manafort, on the other hand, has been convicted for his dealings in the Ukraine. So I think the proof is in the pudding sometimes. You got to look at actually what has unfolded. If people could charge Biden, they would have. If they could charge Manafort, they did. That's a difference between would have and did. Hey, we got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, and we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show in just a couple of minutes. I want to thank Guy Page very much for joining me this morning. And John Walters, are you going to hang out for a little bit, or are you going to take it off?
You're talking to Bill Boardman next, I believe.
Yes.
So, sure.
All right, John's going to stay with us, and Bill Boardman's going to be on the line. We're going to have some more fascinating conversation here. Stay with us, folks.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tone Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Hey, thanks for staying with us, folks. We are back, and my guest John Walters remains in the studio with me. We have Bill Boardman on the phone. Bill sent me a note yesterday. It said, when impeachment becomes a sudden fad with no clear grounding in principle and a narrow focus on pretty much circumstantial evidence grounded in a bed of bipartisan corruption resting on tectonic plates of the new Cold War, I remain detached and skeptical, except the show might be spectacular, especially if viewed from another planet or maybe just China. And I thought that was pretty funny, actually. And so Bill Boardman said, hey, Bill, come on my show. Report to us from your other planet. And
beam me up.
Beam me up. How you doing, Bill?
Well, on this planet, it's one great big circus, but I'm trying to remain detached and skeptical.
Okay.
You do hear the Calliope music in the background sometimes.
Well, anybody who doesn't think it's a circus, I guess, has never experienced a circus.
Well, you know, I guess we just all...
Insult to clowns.
The whole thing about the guy who wrote in the whistleblower.
Yeah.
The first line in his letter cites the statute that's supposed to protect him and that is also supposed to get his report directly to Congress. Mm-hmm. And the very fact that that's been an issue is a paradigm of why Trump has been impeachable since day one. He doesn't follow the law. The Constitution expects the president to faithfully execute the law. And the first thing the White House did was try and keep this, you know, tamp this down.
Yeah, they have an analysis of executive privilege, which essentially the way McGuire described him. This is Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, because it seems everybody down there is just acting these days.
In the sense of performing, perhaps.
Well, yeah. And he was trying to make this presentation to Congress yesterday morning that he essentially was being tugged between a couple of different legal principles. One of them being this you shall share this with the Congress, and the other of this being. Executive privilege. Of course, I think if you start your activities in something like this by going to the targets of the whistleblower complaint, who would be Donald Trump and William Barr, for instance, and saying, hey, should I share this with the Congress? You might end up a little bit betwixt and between, don't you think?
Well, I mean, that is a headset that is so Trumpian. Well, you know, the law says that we should do this. But we have another opinion, so we're going to ignore the law.
Yeah.
Wait, no, you can't do that.
I was saying a few minutes before the break, I think one of the big problems here in terms of the sort of countervailing laws is this OLC memo, which they
that's not a law.
I know it's not a law, but they act as if it is. It's the toughest, firmest law in the books.
Not a law.
I know it's not a law, but they act as if it's the toughest, firmest law on the books because
that is fundamentally a lie.
Listen, I think that at the next Democratic debate, the candidates all ought to be asked to say, if you believe that no person is above the law, would you sign a law? Would you encourage Congress to pass a law and then sign a law saying we are nullifying the OLC memo? Saying that a president can't be prosecuted.
Yeah, where did the OLC memo come from?
The OLC memo came from the executive branch under the direction of a president.
The OLC memo that we're talking about was produced during the Bush administration by the same people who said torture was okay.
That too. And so, this is a
fundamentally political and, I believe, fraudulent document, and Mueller blinked.
So that's why all the Democratic candidates should be asked, would you nullify this political and fraudulent document?
Would you be willing to be subject to prosecution?
Yes,
We have a sitting Congress that hasn't done anything about it for 10 years.
Yep.
Well, it's time to get off the dime, and started doing something, I think. You know, the other thing that I think we're seeing here is that the whole special counsel system that has evolved in this country probably needs to be scrapped. And when a president misbehaves, the Constitution calls for Congress to look into it. And if they determine that the president needs to be impeached, impeach the president, remove the president from office. There's a structure set up for that. The special counsel comes along. This idea of a special counsel comes along and has really mucked up the system because we have this situation where Mueller investigated very thoroughly, put a lot of prosecutorial skill into the work for a couple of years, and then you get to the end of it. Turns out it's a fool's errand because of the OLC memo, and because we have the whole special.
It becomes a fool's errand because he blinked, and Congress has blinked.
Yeah.
If you aren't going to confront the issues head on, the issues are going to confront you. From the backside.
Yeah.
It got to face up. You know, there is no structure for impeachment. Impeachment is like four lines in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rules for it. And I have a chapter in my book talking about impeachment that the way, in my opinion, this is just an opinion, that the way to do it is to do it slow walk. There is so much that Trump has done wrong that's unconstitutional from the day he took office that you can investigate him for the next decade without exhausting it. The environmental crimes, enriching himself at public expense, and so on. In my book, American exceptionalism takes its toll.
Yep.
This is an example of that. We think of ourselves as so perfect, and we don't confront direct attacks on the Constitution.
All right. Well, Bill Boardman, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's good chatting with you, and I think you make some really interesting points here. My next guest is our lone congressman from Vermont. Peter Welch is a Democrat. He has served in office here in Vermont since 2007, and he is a key player in discussions in Washington about the whole impeachment procedure. You came out, Congressman, a few months ago saying that you favored impeachment proceedings beginning. You must be somewhat gratified just to see this next step being taken this week.
I would not say that at all. I mean, it's pretty depressing that we're going to have to spend our time, and I think it's our duty to do it. That's been my conclusion.
Yep.
But I'm not gratified. I'm really, really disappointed that we're in this position where the information came out that literally the President of the United States, who's the custodian of our national security, in a conversation with the President of the Ukraine, basically asked him for a favor, which was to do something with an investigation that was intended to benefit the president's reelection campaign.
Yeah, and the Washington Post now, of course, reporting that they're quoting the prosecutor who Rudy Giuliani was saying needed to take up the mantle again and try to uncover all this nefarious corruption by the Bidens in the Ukraine. And the prosecutor is essentially saying, "Hey, folks, you know what? There's nothing there. We looked into it, and we don't have anything." So, is this something that is just a desperate attempt to fan some sparks, or what do you think the president was up to?
Well, it's pretty clear what the president was up to. He wants to get dirt on Biden.
Mm-hmm.
In any way he can, he will. And by the way, it's really important for us to understand there's a distinction here. If President Trump, in his campaign, if it is against Joe Biden, wants to raise any issue he wants, he can do it. He's free to go after Biden, Biden's son, Ukraine, whatever it is he wants to do. He's free to do that.
Yes.
I don't agree with it. I think it would be dirty politics, but he can do it.
Mm-hmm.
What he can't do is President of the United States is essentially sit on $381 million in aid that was approved by a strong bipartisan majority to a country that is facing imminent takeover by Russia. They took over Crimea. They've got their troops in the Donbass region and on the Ukrainian border with Russia, and essentially want to find out whether the president is going to, quote, play ball and then essentially do a shakedown where, in exchange for me releasing the aid, and keep in mind that aid had been approved and it was only at the president's direction to his chief of staff that it was not distributed, he can't do that. That's jeopardizing the American national security interest for his own political benefit, and it is absolutely illegal for me, for Senator Leahy, for any member of the House or Senate, and the president to solicit foreign assistance in our election campaigns. It's illegal.
John Walters is still here. John, you have a question for the congressman?
Yeah, you just mentioned Senator Leahy, and we had a discussion in the first half hour here. Some conservatives are pointing to a letter that Senator Leahy wrote last year asking the Ukrainian authorities to cooperate with the Mueller investigation. And they're saying that is the Democrats doing the same thing that they're now accusing President Trump of doing. How do you see that comparison?
I see no comparison. First of all, there was an investigation underway, the Mueller investigation. It wasn't requesting Ukraine to, quote, do an investigation. Number two, the request of the Ukrainians was to cooperate with an independent investigation. Number three, and this is really significant, what they were advocating for was justice to be done through Mueller, not something to be done to benefit their reelection campaigns. And that's the big, big, big distinction here with Trump. What he was doing was soliciting, in effect, campaign assistance from a foreign power. That's for his benefit, not for any national interest.
Yeah, I mean, as I said in the first half hour when we were talking about this, if Patrick Leahy had called somebody in Ukraine, a senior prosecutor there, or the president of Ukraine, and said, "Please give me some dirt on Scott Milne," because Milne ran against me in 2016 and might again in 22, I would say impeach Pat Leahy.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Or if Peter Welch did it, I'd say impeach Peter Welch.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because that clearly is beyond the pale and something that should not happen.
Well, and the, you know, the irony, David, is that the president made that phone call the day after Mr. Mueller testified. And I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, he's dedicated his life to our Constitution. And one of the questions I asked him...
You mean Mueller has?
Mueller has.
Yes. Okay, just to be clear who we're talking about here.
Yeah, thank you. But one of the questions I asked him towards the end of the hearing was, Mr. Mueller, do you think this may be the new normal, that we have foreign involvement in our campaigns? And he said he feared it might be. But what was different about the Russian interference, you know, President Trump was denying it, even though all our intelligence agencies were acknowledging it, is that they had their own reasons, the Russians and Putin had their own reasons for getting involved in our campaign. They favored Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But there was not an allegation that Trump made a phone call to Putin asking him to get involved. So the day after Mueller has this lament, you have the president of the United States actually initiating the request for foreign involvement from the Ukraine.
Yeah, that's an evolution from the son of the president saying "I love it" when there's an alleged offer of dirt on the political opponent coming from a foreign country. You know, that was a story with Don Jr. in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That goes way beyond "I love it" and you know, give it. I'm welcoming you giving me something. Now I'm calling and asking for it.
That's exactly right. And what's disturbing to me, and I think to a lot of people, is that the president is the single person in our country who has the power and the ultimate responsibility to protect our national security. And that's existential. And to essentially take advantage of the place he has to withhold aid, threaten to withhold aid, and to seek a benefit for his own campaign at the expense of our national security, I find appalling.
Congressman, do you have a couple of minutes to take a call or two here?
Sure.
All righty. Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Back in 1968, during the height of the Vietnam War, I dedicated my life to the Constitution. I got a question, and the question is, why is the country so polarized? The country was polarized back in 1968, it was polarized back in 1861, and I believe today it's polarized. Why is it so polarized? What's going on?
That is such a good question. And, you know, I ask myself that every day, and I run into Vermonters who ask it. And, you know, by the way, thank you for your service in 1968. That was unbelievable. And when you came back, people did not treat our veterans the way they should be treated. So I really appreciate you. But the polarization question is different now. You know, when we were polarized in 68, and I'm probably around your age, we were actually having battles about issues. What should be our foreign policy? Should we be in that war or not? What about civil rights and making African Americans full and equal partners in this democratic experiment? Those are important and contentious questions. Now the polarization is not about issues. It's like we're denying issues. We're denying climate change. We're denying that facts matter. We're denying science. And I don't know the full answer to why we're there. I can tell you my approach to trying to deal with it. I try to stay as focused as I can on the issues. I try to work with people I disagree with. I try to work as much as I can with Republicans, because we've got to get back to an acknowledgement that only by working together can we make progress going forward. I think a lot of it is economic. You know, I think we've had this huge cleavage in our economy where folks who really work hard, especially in rural America, but aren't on the new economy and all the technological change, a lot of those folks haven't had a raise in 20 years. And that's enormous pressure. And I think the president, frankly, has made a real decision that he's going to try to build his political support by division rather than unity. And that is really contrary to what I normally expect our president, Republican or Democrat, to do. So I don't have the answer, but you are certainly asking the right question.
All righty. I appreciate the call from Fred. Let's go to Ziggy in Newport.
Representative Welch?
Yes.
It's an honor to speak to you, sir.
You too.
Doesn't it raise any red flags to you when we're talking about Hunter Biden being on a government jet plane with his father and making a gazillion dollars with the deal from China, and the same thing in the Ukraine? But my first question was, I lost my train of thought there. My first question was, in the early 90s, under President Clinton, there was a direct treaty with the Ukraine and the United States, with the heads of state, with the governments making a deal to fight crime.
Uh-huh.
Can you explain that for me?
You know what? I don't know about that. So
Well, we should be talking about that because my point is, in defense of Trump, he didn't do anything wrong. But getting back to the red flags, shouldn't that be a question that he makes a gazillion dollars? I mean, my point is, it's a double standard. If that was Trump Jr., I mean, good God, you guys.
All right, Ziggy, let me let the congressman answer your question. Shouldn't there be red flags here about it when there's a gazillion dollars? I don't know how many dollars were involved or how China fits in the picture.
Well, you know, Ziggy's got a point. All right, if there's one of the candidate's son or daughter is getting money, and it looks like it's largely because that country is trying to benefit from connections. That's an issue that the candidates, I think, can bring up in the campaign. So whether it's Hillary talking about some of the Trump children or Trump talking about some of the Biden children in his campaign, if he wants to bring that up, that's fine. And I wouldn't, you know, I might disagree with him, but I wouldn't condemn him that he's bringing up that question. What I do criticize him for and think is a profound breach of his responsibility is when he uses his office in an effort to get a foreign government to assist him with dirt that he's going to use in his campaign. He cannot do that as President of the United States. So what he can do in his campaign is different than what he can do with the authority of the Office of the Presidency of the United States. That's the big difference here.
That is a key difference. Thanks for the call, Ziggy. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joe in Bristol. Good morning, Joe.
Hello. Good morning. Great to speak to Peter. And no, I just had a clarification on what we were speaking of. The president can't be prosecuted. Yes, he can be prosecuted, but not in office.
Right.
And Robert Mueller did not want to bring a case. But he could have brought a case, and the prosecution would have began after Donald Trump left office. I just wanted to make that little clarification. Yes,
well,
he can be prosecuted.
Right, you're right, and thank you for that clarification.
All right, thanks, Joe. Appreciate the call. Hey, Congressman, what do you think about a special counsel system in which the special counsel is a creature of the executive branch?
I hadn't really thought of it.
I mean, it just strikes me as a fundamental conflict of interest, really, because the special counsel ends up working for people who work for the president. And that was the whole, issue with Jeff Sessions and Mr. Rosenstein and the whole lot of them who were involved in overseeing Mueller.
The
president threatening to fire Mueller from time to time. I think there's a real problem here.
Well, you raise a question. In my understanding of special counsel is that it has an immense amount of independence. Has it really been independent, or has it been subject to the influence of the president? I certainly think Mueller was very much an independent actor. Kenneth Starr, on the other hand, I'm not sure was. Seems to be not so much under the influence of, obviously he wasn't under the influence of President Clinton.
And now Donald Trump may be brought to justice by the Congress operating without a special counsel. I just want to point that out.
Well, of course, the Congress would be exercising its constitutional responsibility.
Yep. Sure.
Authority for us acting.
Congressman, we are about top of the hour and out of time. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us this morning. Fascinating conversation, and let's do this again soon.
Yes, thank you.
Alrighty. We're going to take some time for some CBS News at the top of the hour, a little conversation with one of our talk media news correspondents following that. And then Allison Stanger, professor at Middlebury College, who is, what timing, just out with a new book on whistleblowers, is going to be talking to us in the second hour of the program. And John Walters, are you going to hang out, or do you need a...
I think I better hit the road.
Okay, well, John Walters, thanks very much for coming in this morning. You were a big help. It's always good to see you. And we'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back for the second hour of our program on this Friday morning, September the 27th, 2019. And I do believe Talk Media News' Tom Squitieri is on the line with us. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct.
Good morning, Tom. Happy Friday.
Good morning. Thank you.
What a wild week it has been. So is the whistleblower almost a spy, as the president says?
If so, he's really acting in the best interest of the United States.
Susan Collins of Maine actually just came out with a statement.
Let me sit down for this one.
Yeah, she says, calling whistleblower almost a spy, she says, that's a gross mischaracterization of whistleblowers. And
that's true.
And which is, kind of obvious and so on. But I would say here that the... interesting that this quote happens to pop up from the Republican senator from Maine, of course, has been faulted by a lot of liberals for instance, her support of the Brent Kavanaugh appointment to the Supreme Court. But here she is. Maybe there's a little bit of a crack in the Republican armor here. Of course, we've seen a couple of other comments this week from Republicans, especially in the Senate, indicating some displeasure. And Margaret Chase Smith, you may remember the.
I remember her well. Yeah,
Senator from Maine.
Susan Collins has a long way to go to even touch the shadow of Margaret Chase Smith.
Or you could say we knew Margaret Chase Smith and Susan Collins. You know Margaret Chase Smith.
That's right. Now, Susan Collins, who has been in the Senate a long time, and if my memory is correct, she was she worked on Capitol Hill before she was elected to office.
Uh-huh.
She knows how the system works, and she's always taken this position. Where she gets to be noted as undecided or a swing vote and all that. And in the end, she seems to always vote the Republican line, which, of course, is her prerogative.
Yep.
She's up for re-election next year, I believe. And so I would take anything that I am taking anything she says in context of her history of saying things that to indicate that she perhaps is thinking to be perhaps a non-party line vote. And then meld that with the fact that she's up for re-election next year. Walk the walk, talk the talk, blah, blah, blah.
So you're not really buying that she's suddenly seeing the light or something.
No, I'm not. Okay. It's like I read a story this morning, former Senator Flake of Arizona, Republican Senator Flake of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get along well with President Trump.
Nope.
He had a story I read this morning said that he believes that there are 35 members of the Republican Party in the Senate who would vote... quote unquote for impeachment, if the vote was private. Well, you know what? The vote isn't private, nor should it be private. If you're going to vote to impeach the president of the United States, that has to be a public vote, obviously. So it doesn't matter what these people are saying in private. If they believe it's wrong, this may be the time to say it in public. I think your governor, who's a Republican, said something yesterday, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He came out and he said he approves, he supports the inquiry, the impeachment inquiry. He's not going so far as to say.
Well, but that's fine.
Yeah.
And that, you know what? Listen, we don't know what an inquiry will show. I'm not going to jump to any conclusions, nor are you,
nor
is he. But the fact that he says he thinks that it merits an inquiry, I'm putting words in his mouth perhaps, but that's a strong statement for a Republican to say.
That is for sure. Yeah. I mean, certainly it's a long way from what what Representative Devin Nunes was saying in the Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday when they had Joe McGuire in, yeah. And Nunes was just tearing into the Democrats and the evil media, et cetera. So,
oh, my gosh, yeah. I know. These guys, yeah. That's the only thing they have to fall back on. And, you know, in this case, you and I talked about this, I believe, on Tuesday briefly.
Mm-hmm.
But since Tuesday, it shows that the president acted on his own. There's no Robert Mueller, you know, no Democratic, effort here. Giuliani's his self-appointed consigliere, you know, is out there doing his thing and reporting to the State Department. And then the president tried to throw the Pentagon under the bus yesterday or Wednesday, saying they were the ones that asked to hold back Dave, which is completely false, you know, because they certified it in May. This is not me, my opinion. This is me who covers the Pentagon. I know this, and it's public record.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, it's not anything Nevin Nolan's or anyone can say it's the media's fault.
I know. I sometimes I'm putting my tongue a little bit in cheek, and I hope my listeners understand sometimes when I I think part of me says, well, you kind of have to quote them with a straight face here and there, and let their own words speak for themselves. Hey, I wanted to ask.
Yeah, I always wanted. Let me ask you a journalistic question on that point, if you don't mind.
Nope.
So yeah, we do. We quote these guys, these individuals on all sides.
Yeah.
And we do. That's our job, and let the readers decide and let the listeners decide.
Yep.
But there is also, I think, an occasion where, in this case, someone says these things, and it's fair to say he offered no evidence to back his contention.
Yeah.
My tongue's in cheeks now, too.
No, I get you. That's a convention that I've used it from time to time in covering Vermont politics and so on. I see this line repeatedly throughout the course of this week. There's no evidence that Biden or Joe or Hunter Biden did anything wrong. Of course, now there's a fresh story from the Washington Post quoting the prosecutor in Ukraine saying, we looked into this and there's nothing there.
Right.
Let me ask you a couple.
I'm intent on reemphasizing this point whenever I can.
Okay.
That regardless of what the president may or may have done, it's irrelevant to what Joe Biden's Hunter Biden may or may not done, and vice versa. If the Bidens did something wrong, then they should be discovered on that. But that doesn't take away or diminish whatever the president has done. If he's saying, well, I did this because the Bidens were doing this, or we did this, but look into them. Hey, it doesn't work that way. If you did something wrong, you did something wrong. If the getaway car left you at the bank holding the bag, you're holding the bag, and the guy who drove away is still guilty if he's caught. But he's not. You are.
Yeah, or even maybe a purer analogy here is there's a bank robbery on Wednesday and the bank robber gets away. There's a bank robbery on Thursday. The bank robber gets caught and the bank robber on Thursday says, you should let me go.
That's right. There you go. That's better. You're right. That's much better. Yeah.
So, no, I think actually the bank robber on Thursday may have had a little bit less luck, but still is.
And also, I would question his timing.
Well, there is that as well.
It might be less money in the bank.
Tom, two underlying questions I do want to get to.
Okay.
This one is, are we going to look back on 2019 and history will record that this a straight impeachment process works a lot better than appointing a special prosecutor?
That's a really good question. That's a really good thing, and I would believe that in the circumstances of our time, in other words, as opposed to the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
The answer probably is yes.
And then the other question is, should, and this one you may have, I may have voiced to you before because I have on the show, but I'm really wondering whether we ought to scrap the OLC memo that says a sitting president can't be prosecuted. And I actually think it would be a great question for the next Democratic debate for the moderator or, you know, the reporters panel to say, hey, candidates, you are all going to tell me that you believe no one is above the law. So are you going to advocate for the Congress to pass, and will you sign when it gets to your desk, legislation scrapping the OLC memo?
That's a very good question as well. And I think that's one that I'd like to hear all candidates address, as well as some legal scholars. That would be a show I would definitely want to watch. Look, if no one is above the law, no one is above the law. And
yeah.
That's pretty straightforward equation.
Should be.
And so then somehow. The president, yeah, I mean, there's reasons to remove the president from office that you can impeach him or her from off, you know, and remove them for cause, I guess.
Yep.
But it's complicated, and I don't know. I think it's worth revisiting.
Yeah. Well,
and I don't mean that just because of President Trump. I just think that for, you know, of any president, I mean, I don't care what party he or she is of, or if they're independent, if they're breaking the law, that's even worse, you know, because presidents should be held to a higher standard.
The president should be held to a higher, not a lower standard. So
Yeah.
I mean, part of the problem is two big things that I see here. One is that there's just a fundamental conflict of interest because the special counsel, in the case of Mr. Mueller, is a creature of the executive branch. You know, Trump kept threatening to fire him. He's working for Rosenstein, who was working for ended up working for William Barr, was earlier working for Jeff Sessions, and so that's a real problem. The executive branch is effectively investigating itself, which is just completely wrong, if you ask me. And we're seeing some shades of that in this current dust up over the Ukraine business. So I really think that the special counsel is a very problematic system that has evolved, and maybe the thing ought to just be purified, and we ought to say, look, if the president misbehaves, Congress can do its own investigation. If Congress determines the misbehavior is bad enough, impeach the person. You know, end of story.
There could be a better way. Now, I was thinking back to the 70s during Watergate, and
yep.
They had special investigators, you know, Archibald, they were fired and everything, and they kept having them.
Yeah.
And then... there also was, of course, the Senate Special Committee on Watergate,
yeah.
You know, headed by yep. Senator Ervin and others, which did a lot of the work as well. So if you look at how that worked in tandem, that seemed to be pretty good. And also remember the outrage when Nixon had this, you know, the prosecutors fired. There was a bipartisan outrage and all that. There,
right,
was,
just, right.
There was a thing I saw on Twitter, which I had made me laugh. It was that someone was asking, who's going to be the Barry Goldwater of this administration? In other words, you remember Barry Goldwater went and told Nixon essentially he had to go or something like
yeah,
that.
Yep.
And they listed four Republican senators. I won't repeat the names. I looked at all four of them. I said, well, there's not a Goldwater in that bunch.
Yeah. Well,
so the times are different.
The times are certainly different. Hey, Tom Scutari, I really appreciate you joining me this morning, and we'll talk again, I'm sure, next week. Have a good weekend.
Yep. See ya.
And I'm very happy to say that my next guest is Allison Stanger. She is a professor, the Russell Lang 60 Professor of International Politics and Economics at Middlebury College right here in Vermont. She's a New America Cybersecurity Fellow and an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Wow. And she's also the author of a new book called Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Washington, in that case, was George Washington. Allison Stanger, I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
I also want to congratulate you on your timing. The publication of your book of September 24th, 2 days before one of the most consequential, perhaps one of the most consequential whistleblower reports in American history is released.
Yeah.
You gotta be walking on cloud nine this week, aren't you?
Well, no, it's a crazy coincidence, and I'm just really excited that we're finally, I think, at a tipping point with a trend I lay out in Whistleblowers,
mm-hmm.
which is that the intelligence community is blowing the whistle on Donald Trump for failing to uphold his oath to the Constitution. And that's something that's been going on since he's been elected, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. So my book puts what's happening right now in historical context, going all the way back to George Washington.
And that's really amazing. I saw the excerpt from your book that you published this week in The Atlantic, and this fascinating story about a sea captain named Hopkins, who was from a big Rhode Island family involved in the slave trade, mm-hmm. was also a key player in the founding days of the U.S. Navy, and did some stuff, basically ignored the orders he was getting for various naval strategies and engagements and so on, and went off and kind of did his own thing, and then his subordinates essentially reported him to the Continental Congress, right?
That's right, and that's the reason we have our first whistleblower protection law, which dates all the way back to 1778, because Essex Hopkins, who was the first Commodore of the U.S. Navy, was essentially using his public office for private gain. He was defying George Washington, who would send him and his ships to engage the British in various places to support the Revolutionary War effort. And what Hopkins did instead was he took the ships where he needed to take them to advance his economic interests as a slave runner. So,
yeah,
so
wow.
It's a really interesting story to think about where the origins of our whistleblower protection laws come from and our reverence for whistleblowers.
And you know, I guess I would have thought that the whistleblower protection would have emanated from the Watergate era or something like that. You know, obviously Mark Felt, the famous Deep Throat, was another very consequential whistleblower in American history. Here we are with Congress passing its first Whistleblower Protection Act in 1778. That was kind of a forehead slapper to me, I got to say.
Yeah, it explains something, really, because, you know, whistleblowing is really in America's DNA. It's part of who we are as a democracy, and that's part of the reason when you see the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, unanimously support the whistleblower complaint going forward. It's because whistleblowing is American. It's patriotic. It's not partisan. And so that's why this may be a turning point in this whole saga, in my view.
Yeah, you know, when you see that internal corruption in government and you're sitting at the next desk or whatever it is, or you're on the poop deck and your captain is taking the ship to the wrong place, whatever it is,
yeah.
I guess the idea that you're supposed to be able to report that and have it not come back to severely bite you, isn't that all part of the process of trying to make a quote-unquote more perfect union?
Absolutely. So, and whistleblowing is an important way of keeping elites honest, and it's not a partisan issue, it's an American issue. We can't have a democracy and self-government if we can't distinguish between truth and fiction, and if, you know, the powerful get to decide what the truth is.
Yeah,
in a democracy, the people decide what the truth is.
And so tell me a little bit about the some of the other great cases of whistleblowers. This habit that we have in this country, and not just in this country, we see this occasionally popping up overseas as well. But in American history, whistleblowers have played key roles at a variety of junctures. Give us some examples, maybe through the, you know, the 19th and 20th centuries.
Sure. I mean, you have the first Lincoln Law. The False Claims Act during the Civil War, and that's because American companies were selling uniforms that would disintegrate to the Union Army. They were made out of something called shoddy. So the word shoddy actually comes from fraudulent activity during the Civil War, where these companies were, at the expense of the United States, making money.
The fabric itself was called shoddy, right?
Yeah, it was called shoddy. Yeah.
Wow, that is interesting. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So this has a long history, and you know, whistleblowers. My book takes you through the whole sweep of it. But some other prominent figures would be Boss Tweed, who in the first Gilded Age in New York City was this utterly corrupt politician, a Democrat. So this is not a partisan issue.
Yep.
But unlike the president, Tweed actually built up the infrastructure of New York City in a completely corrupt way. He made money doing it.
Yeah.
But something actually got built, and that's so striking about our current situation is, you know, there's all sorts of maneuvering for self-interest, but nothing's getting done. You know, there's no infrastructure being built, and that's why we're at a turning point, I hope, where we can turn the country around and get back on track and get back on doing things that need to get done to close the gap between American ideals and reality.
Well, and of course, your mention of infrastructure is quite telling because that was a campaign promise in 2016, as I recall.
Absolutely. I wish Donald Trump were more like Boss Tweed, because then we'd maybe have better public transportation.
We've got the bad of Boss Tweed without the good. Is that what you're saying?
I would put it that way, yeah. We're in a second Gilded Age, I think.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But I mean, you. I don't know what you're interested in, but you can take it through to Daniel Ellsberg. There's a really fascinating whistleblower by the name of Buddy Greenhouse.
Well, let's talk about Ellsberg for a minute. That was a famous one, actually featured just a couple of years ago in a terrific movie called The Post, about the Washington Post's role in exposing the Pentagon Papers, as they were called. Walk us through that history, because a lot of people may be getting a little hazy on it.
Well, it's during the Vietnam War, and really Daniel Ellsberg is our first whistleblower in the modern era, and you see the term becoming more frequently used in the media from that point forward.
Mm-hmm.
He basically exposed that the administration was lying to the American people about the conduct of the Vietnam War.
And that applied to the Johnson as well as the Nixon administration, right?
Yeah, just a lot of lies. So Ellsberg exposed lies, and it also turned into a great First Amendment issue, if you will recall, where the New York Times was vindicated for publishing the information because of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
So whistleblowers are intimately connected to First Amendment freedoms, and the two reinforce each other.
Well, and whistleblowers obviously are, as somebody who worked in Vermont for a long time as a journalist, I'm very grateful for the existence of whistleblowers, as any citizen should be, but journalists in particular, because a lot of the best stories that have come out over the years have been as a result of whistleblowers going to the press because they can't get any traction inside their own organizations.
That's right. That's a tip. You know, if institutions were functioning properly, when a whistleblower complaint comes forward, it should be able to be resolved within the organization. They should make the reforms, and everybody benefits. But what often happens is people don't want to hear truth being spoken to power, and so the whistleblower has to go outside, and a free press is their protection.
Yeah, and I must say, as a longtime journalist, I'm kind of glad that that these problems aren't solved internally, because it keeps us in business.
Yeah. Well, you certainly play a valuable role.
I actually think, I mean, Ellsberg, that was a fascinating case there, where Ellsberg basically was able to produce the Pentagon Papers for the New York Times. And then, of course, I would guess you've probably seen the movie The Post. It's a terrific story in the beginning of the Washington Post,
yeah,
trying to catch up with the New York Times. So there's a lot of just competitive juices flowing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great film.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed that film.
Yeah, and Meryl Streep as the publisher of the Washington Post just absolutely knocked it out of the park, I thought. So.
Yeah, and actually that movie is what led me to marry Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg's daughter, whom I was able to interview for my book. So
that's
I got some more. Yeah.
That is wonderful. We're going to be going to a bottom of the hour break in just a minute or two. And before we do that, I wanted to just cover one thing with you, and then we'll continue our conversation about whistleblowers afterward. I hope you have fully recovered from the injuries you suffered in I believe it was the winter of 17, was it?
Yes, it was March 2017.
And that was the melee at Middlebury College that ensued from Charles Murray's appearance there. You were, what was your role? You were the MC, sort of, or how did that work?
I just was invited by the students invited into campus, and I was the person they asked to ask the first three or four tough questions.
I see. Okay. And that was, I think in some people's minds, you were sort of linked to him, but you were not. You were asking tough questions, as you put it.
I'm consistent.
Yeah. Hey, Allison Stenger, please stay with us. We're going to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour, a couple words from sponsors, and continue our conversation on the other side. Listeners, stay with us as well. I think we're going to get into some good stuff here.
Okay, great.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Tote & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And I just want to remind folks about our podcast. Don't forget, you can listen to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV any time of day or night, thanks to the internet. Just go to the WDEV homepage, that WDEVradio.com. Follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, you'll find a list of our recent programs and recent guests, and select any of them you want and listen to your heart's content. You can't call us at 2 or 3 in the morning, but you certainly can listen. And a lot of people tell me they're busy between 9 and 11 a.m. when we're live on the air weekdays, but they try to listen in later on, whether they're cooking dinner or after they put the kids to bed or whatever it is, wherever it fits in your day, you can fit in some of our program here. And I think a lot of folks are going to be maybe tuning in over the weekend to check out our interview this morning. Our several interviews with dealing with the news this week about the U.S. House launching an impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. My current guest is Allison Stanger. She is a professor at Middlebury College and is the author of a new book that just came out this week, Whistleblowers, Honesty from Washington to Trump. And Allison Stanger, thanks for staying with us. It's really this is really an honor to have you on. And as I mentioned earlier, what great timing for both of us, I think. Your publication this week and me having booked you as a guest a couple of weeks ago. I'm thinking, wow. So let's continue our conversation about some of the big whistleblowing cases that maybe in recent American history. We were talking about Daniel Ellsberg. Mark Felt, what do you make of that? And, of course, he continued anonymous as Deep Throat for decades after the Watergate case had ebbed from the front pages, certainly.
Yes, unlike the current whistleblower, he kept his identity secret for decades. It was only revealed just before his death. But he's a good example of a whistleblower who had kind of mixed motives. In Whistleblowers, I write about his story. He had aspirations to be the head of the FBI, and part of his leaking served those interests. But what I argue is that I really don't look at motives in my book, because to me it's all about what misconduct is revealed. You know, whistleblowing is about revealing corruption, illegal conduct, and it sort of doesn't matter what the motives are. It's really what the revelation contains, and so he's a whistleblower by that definition. But we wouldn't have brought down Richard Nixon without Mark Felt.
Yeah, and I actually think that it is a tough thing, actually, you know, again, thinking of my work as a journalist over the years here. And, of course, I was covering a state government in a state which is famous for not being very corrupt as these things go, typically. So I certainly don't have the experience that folks who are playing journalism in big cities or certainly in the nation's capital have with this kind of thing. But from time to time, people would come forward, and you do have to, I think, as a journalist, make yourself aware as you can of the sort of side motivations that might be bringing the whistleblower to come and talk to you. And because you need to put all this kind of, the more context you have, obviously the better, and it does help sometimes. And frankly, sometimes people who want to blow the whistle are telling a pretty, shall we say, one-sided and or at times even inaccurate story. So you got to be really careful, I guess, is the...
And it's really important to use the right language. So, for example, you know, you've got to evaluate your sources. Someone's going to leak something to you, and you've got to evaluate whether that source is legitimate, what other motives they might have to have. But all leakers aren't whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are really revealing misconduct.
Yes.
Something that the person in power wants to keep secret. And that's what's so interesting about what's going on right now is the cover-up piece as well as the specific allegations.
Yeah, that's why I think all journalism students, to my knowledge, most don't these days, but all journalism students should take an undergraduate class in a branch of philosophy called epistemology, which is basically the study of how you know things. How do you know that?
It's hard to know what you know. by no means simple, but we have to insist on a distinction between fact and falsehood if we're going to have a democracy.
Absolutely. We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Marcia in Barrie. Good morning, Marcia.
Morning. Morning to both of you. I have two questions. The first one is, the first one is, could you talk about Ralph Nader's contribution to the modern whistleblower statute? And the second one is, what do you think about Edward Snowden, who said that he could not take advantage of the modern statute because he was a contract worker?
Very interesting. Let me go to that first question about Ralph Nader's role in the development of the modern whistleblower statutes. What can you tell us, Allison Stanger?
Well, obviously, you're absolutely right that Ralph Nader played a critical role in elevating the importance of whistleblowing for American consumer safety. So he's an important part of the story. He doesn't feature in my book that prominently because I'm really focused on public servants. The book, you know, developed in a crazy way. I mean, it went through 5 manuscript iterations, and I cut hundreds of pages of carefully sourced prose and decided to focus on national security and government rather than some of the corporate cases, but that's a whole other interesting area to look at.
Maybe there's a sequel for you.
yeah, no, and I've got all that stuff that I already wrote, so
yeah.
So I'll be looking into that in the future.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, just with response to your second question with Snowden, his contractor status did make things more complicated. You need to know that national security whistleblowing is really fraught and dangerous, which is why Snowden had to flee the country. And the reason it's dangerous is because there's a law, a statute that says all government employees get protection. But it has a national security exception. If you're a national security employee, the law doesn't apply to you. So that's why we have the Intelligence Community Inspector General, because that's put together by an Obama executive order just to try to preserve some sort of way for whistleblowers to function within the intelligence community. And without that, we wouldn't have the whistleblower today. But Snowden's contractor status also complicated still more, because not only was he a national security employee, he was also a contractor. And even the executive order, you can read it both ways, might not apply to contractors. So he, I think, made the right call in leaving the United States, difficult though that decision was.
Yeah, and of course, I read recently that he would like to come back and is, I think, kind of putting that word out there. I don't know whether that's going to be able to happen and or, you know.
I think I'm not too loud. Okay.
All right. Okay. Marcia, thanks so much for the call. I'm hearing a little interference there, so I'm going to let you go. But Dr. Stanger, I just wanted also to go a little more deeply into the Edward Snowden case, because it is so fascinating and raises such issues. You mentioned something a moment ago, though, which prompts the question. The current sort of system within the intelligence community of having a whistleblower go to the intelligence community inspector general that was set up by an executive order just under the Obama administration?
Yeah, it's called Presidential Policy Directive 19, and it's a response to what happened with the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. So that's the act that provides whistleblower protection for everybody except national security employees.
Mm-hmm.
That passes in 1989. It's re-upped in 2012. And again, some people want to have national security employees in there, but the activist organizations compromise and keep them out just to get the legislation to be strengthened.
Yeah.
But Obama's executive order sets up the ICIG and has some kind of contradictory statements about contractors that would make it seem as though the protection didn't apply.
Right.
It's already shaky because it's at odds with the statute. But as the guidelines of the ICIG state, you're obligated to report violations of law or violations of executive order. So they're both relevant.
Wow, that is fascinating. And
kind of complicated, but
fast forward to now, where
it is
an intelligence employee who blows the whistle and sends a report to the Inspector General of the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. Which I guess all of this stuff that is now coming out just this week was under the rubric of the Obama executive order. Is that right?
That's right. We wouldn't have that without President Obama.
I did not know that. So we have a case where basically President Trump, if he's aware of this, he must be kind of be kicking himself and saying, "Boy, there's an Obama executive order I forgot to reverse."
Well, let's keep that from him.
Yeah. Just keep it a secret.
The whole thing is, you know, just this volley of spin, and it's important to stay focused on the facts. And the facts are, this is the most important thing to take away, is that this national security whistleblower is courageous for doing what he or she is doing. There are all these obstacles in his or her way, and coming forward was a really patriotic act, in no way a partisan act. So whatever you hear politicians saying, this is a genuine patriot who's concerned about the future of his or her country.
Yeah, you know, I think that point can't be emphasized enough here. And as I've said in many instances here, if this were directed at a Democratic president, I've got some listeners out there who, when they hear me criticize President Trump, they want to just say, "Oh, you're just a liberal," and you know, to heck with you. But if this were a Democratic president in similar circumstances, having the whistle blown on him or her like this, I would be exactly on the same page. I really do think. I really do hope, frankly. So. That's just something that I feel I need to point out from time to time, because we've had a couple calls already this morning where, you know, this is just a Democrat / liberal media witch hunt and et cetera. And I don't really see it that way at all.
It isn't that way. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, there's been some conservative pushback this week, which I wanted to ask you about. In May of 18, Senators Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Robert Menendez of New Jersey, and Dick Durbin of Illinois wrote a letter to a senior prosecutor in the Ukraine in which they said they didn't want to see the Ukraine interfere with any aspects of the Mueller investigation that might involve people in that country. Now, remember, one of the key convictions obtained by the Mueller investigation was against Paul Manafort, having to do with his work in the Ukraine, of all things. Wow. So, go ahead.
Yeah. No, my book really lays this all out. I was sort of like Carrie Matheson Homeland. Have you ever watched Homeland?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Great show.
So, I mean, trying to put this together, I had all the dots and the strings on the wall trying to connect things. And I really trace how the intelligence community has been blowing the whistle on Donald Trump since his election. So there's all these puzzle pieces, and it's very confusing. But I think what's most important to realize is that the whistleblower complaint indicates a cover-up. And cover-up is usually a red flag. And what the cover-up involves is both a national security threat as well as a threat to democracy from within. And there I'm speaking of, with the national security threat, it's this rogue foreign policy. The idea that the president's personal lawyer is making the foreign policy of the United States directly at odds with the stated position of the United States as developed and overseen by the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have this kind of rogue foreign policy, which is a national security threat, because for obvious reasons. But there's also the threat to democracy from within, which has to do with this solicitation of foreign electoral interference. And the idea that the Attorney General is part of, you know, the functional equivalent of Giuliani on his team, when he's actually supposed to be the enforcer of impartial justice in the United States. So that politicization of justice is very alarming.
Yeah, I too think that the... And some of the conservatives are arguing that it's happening for both sides. They accuse Leahy, Menendez, and Durbin of doing exactly that when they're asking that the Mueller investigation not be interfered with or be helped. And maybe you can shed some light on this, since you've looked into this more carefully than I have, Dr. Stanger. What the United States was trying to get Ukraine to, what was Robert Mueller looking for in Ukraine, and was he getting sufficient help, and was that threatened?
Well, the main pattern is, you have to understand that Ukraine, you know, is something that Russia wants to control.
Right.
And the one thing we know about Donald Trump is that he has some bizarre obsession with Russia.
Yes,
which I trace very meticulously in the book, and indeed, the New York Times is reporting today that there are no less than five Trump meetings with Putin, which took place without interpreters present or the the memos have been buried. And so that's the thing to keep in mind, is that Ukraine thing connects to the Russia
piece. Yes.
Because what you see in the Mueller report is extensive evidence of what I would call coordination, we'll avoid the term collusion, coordination with a foreign power to advance Trump's electoralist interest. And that is just unprecedented.
So right.
To me, the Mueller report was game over. But I'm on top of it. You know, I'm like buried in it, in all the details.
Yep.
And what's distinctive about this case is that it's just so clean cut. It's a short memo. You can read it.
Right.
And you see what the problem is.
You don't have to wade through 440 pages that come to a conclusion, which is quite unsatisfying to most people in that it doesn't really exonerate the president, but it also doesn't conclude by saying, let's prosecute him. So since we were talking about this overall picture of what has been happening in Washington, let me ask you a couple of questions about it that I asked to a previous guest, and I'm just interested in getting a range of views. One question goes like this. Should we scrap the whole special counsel idea? I mean, as people look back on 2019, we may get to a place where we say the Mueller investigation really ended up being quite ineffective, in part because of the OLC memo, which I'll ask about in a moment. But the Mueller thing really ended in a dud, kind of. And now we have the Congress saying, let's do an impeachment inquiry. And this looks like it might be a path that will bring some results. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that straight impeachment is better than the special counsel system?
No, I don't see this as an indictment of the special counsel system at all. It's functioning in a different way because of the unusual political situation right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, if we want to have the Office of the Special Counsel is a mechanism of accountability. And with a White House that believes in the omnipotence of executive power, it's not going to function so well. Under a different president, it does function well. So I don't think we need to get rid of it. I just think that the whistleblower issue, ultimately, Mueller was right to say that the American people have to decide.
You don't think there's a fundamental conflict of interest, though, in the fact that the special counsel is a creature of the executive branch and is investigating the executive branch?
Well, not with a normal president. It definitely is a problem with the president we presently have.
Okay.
It functioned well under other administrations. So
yeah, I'd love a system that worked under any administration. You know, it didn't matter who the president was. If it's a legal instrument, it's supposed to work the same for everybody, right?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the way you can do that is, and I argue this in Whistleblowers, is that it would be easy to get bipartisan support for strengthened whistleblower protection that would extend to the national security employees.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way you could give them, you could make the system better, is to get rid of that exemption.
Yeah, yeah.
For national security employees. So that's one small way you could do it.
Strengthen it, yeah. The other question I have is about the Office of Legal Counsel memo, which essentially is what a kind of, I don't know, muffled the final note of the Mueller symphony, shall we call it. And, I mean, Mueller got to the conclusion of this huge two-year effort, and basically it landed with a whimper in which he said, I can't prosecute, and by the way, here you go, Congress, take it away. Maybe the Congress just should have, on the Office of Legal Counsel memo, should that be scrapped?
No, I think perhaps I would have to really spend more time thinking about it and looking at it. You're raising a really interesting question, but the more likely path to reform, is that we see new legislation that addresses the shortcomings that are already there. And you're right. You're absolutely right. You get these sort of contradictory mechanisms sometimes that are working at cross purposes, but Congress can act to rectify that.
We could talk for another hour here, except we've come up to the end of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Yeah. Dr. Allison Stenger, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. The book is Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, from Washington to Trump. And I'm impressed. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All righty, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned for Bill Sayers, Common Sense Radio. We'll be back Monday with another edition of our program. Have a great weekend, everybody.